Welcome back to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. For those that are single, who have been single for a long period of time before finding your current spouse or partner, I'm sure you've been told at one point you're too picky, you're too needy, or some variation of what I just said. People are always trying to find reasons behind the singleness, but maybe you really aren't the problem. There's nothing wrong with knowing what you like and what you don't like. There's nothing wrong with making your own money and taking initiatives, having a degree, and being CEOs, and there's absolutely nothing wrong for wanting attention and for wanting to be with the right person who adores you. Our guest today is the author of the book, It's Not You, 27 Wrong Reasons You're Single. She's a freelance writer and has written for the New York Times, for Forbes, for Time Out Magazine, Martha Stewart Living, Self Magazine, Glamour Magazine, just to name a few. You're going to really enjoy this podcast. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, she's in the studio, which is really nice. I get to see, you know, the person I'm speaking to. I always ask this as the first question. What made you write the book?
Well, I have been a writer for quite a long time. I started full-time freelancing in about 1997. And, you know, I'd spent a lot of years thinking about a book project and trying various things. Nothing really worked. And I had written on this topic. I met my husband when I was 39, and I had spent the previous 20 years kind of wondering what was wrong with me, that I couldn't find a relationship. And after meeting my husband, and actually a little bit before meeting my husband, it occurred to me that perhaps I was just fine, that I just hadn't met the right person yet. And I wrote a piece for Self about that before we got married, and that did really well. And when I had been younger, I had also written a piece in the 90s about kind of a relationship drought and then meeting someone and kind of having a similar epiphany. And so it occurred to me that whenever I wrote on this topic, the world really opened up. I wrote another piece for the New York Times Modern Love column about this and got letters really from around the world from people saying, "This, I'm you, your story is mine." And so I realized this is what I can write about that would actually be useful, as opposed to writing about something that makes me, that can show everybody what a great writer I am or what a success I am. I thought this is something people, when I write about this topic, people write to me and they say thank you. So I thought,
Sarah, it is the most useful. There are three things that normally surround everyone's life and worry: money, love, and health.
Mm-hmm.
And depending upon what's missing, it's equally as painful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, poverty is painful. But loneliness is probably what drives most drug addictions. It's what drives lots of suicides. It's what drives the frustration and the self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's the greatest mistake that men and women make, is rather than asking the question, what's wrong with me, they ask the question is, you know, who am I and what do I need to do to, first of all, within inside myself, feel like I am worth it and worthy of a relationship. Some people just don't feel they're worthy. So the title itself is what everyone, I can't see anyone passing by Barnes & Noble's and not picking up your book and flipping through it, because we live in New York City and it is one of the most single place in the world.
Yeah.
You know. So let's start by telling me some of the 27 mistakes that people make, and let's kind of look at them.
Well, when I talk to women about what other people said to them about why they're single, and I mean, there are two things that happen.
This is mostly women or men too?
I wrote the book for men and women, and there are certainly men who have written to me and who read the book and follow me on Twitter, but I would say it's primarily women who seem to be responding the most to the book. I'd say maybe 80-85%.
Do you know why that is?
Women. Yeah, why?
I'm going to tell you why it is. It's because when you want to understand anything, you try to take it from the atomic level or the anthropological level. You know, in the cave, a man was defined by, I call it the three Ps, the power of his strength, the strongest guy became the king of the cave, the power of his wealth, he had more camels, he became strong, or the power of the penis, his ability to impregnate. Where women, in going back, back to those early days of Homo sapien life, their power was in two things, in the relationships that they had. The queen of the cave had power because of association. That's why when women talk, you know, they ask, well, what does the guy do? How much money does he have? And men say, you know, how does she look? How tall is she? And for women, beauty was one of those things that that gave her power within the cave, which is why women get more fearful because they perceive that their beauty has a time span to it. And they have, that's why teenagers have more power, women than boys, and in their 20s still, but in their 30s, the power change shifts. So that's why a lot of women unconsciously get really nervous, because they feel, if I miss it now, I'm going to have less and less and less of a chance. Plus also the idea of getting pregnant and having kids. But people don't walk around with those reasons, and in fact, they do make a lot of mistakes. And the fact that you worked with women, women normally worry more about relationships because of, I don't know if we call it the unfairness or just the fact that if you're 30 years old, you could date the 25-year-old. If you're 40 years old, you could date the 25-year-old. If you're 50 years old, you could date the 30-year-old. Meaning, depending upon the success, you know, of the man, you know, because the symbol of wealth and success and stability becomes something that's a little bit safer.
What's interesting, though, is that when you look at after the marriage happens, it's the men who tend to benefit from it more and to get more happiness from the marriage. And women are actually more likely to leave the marriage. So it's kind of funny that perhaps women are more invested in this idea of the relationship and making it work, but the men are the ones that actually benefit from it, even though we have this idea of the guy who doesn't want to commit.
I completely agree with you. I think the man benefits because I think women make the home. They make, you know, they carry the burden of making sure that everything is going the way it is, and generally the men make the mistake of stop treating their wives like the way they treated you when you were a girlfriend and stop becoming passionate and intimate. And they think their only job now is to make money and provide. So the women leave as for the same reason they're in pain when they're single, because they're lonely in the marriage. And the only worst thing of loneliness outside of being single is being lonely in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely agree. Women are having trouble finding guys and they're making mistakes. So let's go through me, Sarah. Tell me the mistakes they're making, both in mindset and in action.
I don't necessarily think that they're necessarily making a lot of mistakes. I mean, one thing, when I ask people, women, what do you hear most about, what do other people say to you the most about why you're single? And the one that I heard most commonly was, you are too picky. And I know that there is this idea of the woman who has all kinds of requirements about he has to be, you know, 6 feet tall and make, you know, some huge salary. But that was never, you know, the women that I spoke to, they're just like, no, I just want somebody that I can talk to who is nice and who will also, you want the attraction, you want the chemistry. But so I think there's this idea, this stereotype of women with all of these unrealistic standards, but I didn't really see that. And I thought, well, I mean, I was picky too. And that has worked out very well for me because I met someone who I just have a really great, easy relationship with because we're just compatible.
You know what? One should be picky. You're not buying a car or leasing a car that you return every 2 years.
Yeah.
There is, though, a difference between waiting for the right person who you're really going to feel as comfortable conversing with as being silent with, where the lovemaking is still lovemaking and not fucking after, 3 months or 6 months. But I do say that there are lots of women who are, that they have so much fear that they look for something that they themselves are not willing to commit to. Like some women who say, I want this guy to be 6 feet, and in perfect shape, and they're 5'2 and 180 pounds. And I want them to make millions, and they're not gainfully employed. In my own experience, I find that the women who are in the best shape, who are extremely successful, are less picky. And they'll say, I want someone who I feel safe with, who I could count on, who I could grow with and experience life with. I find that the women who are literally that you would converse with and look at and, have a lot of self-esteem, have less requirements, but they do want, like everyone else, they want the magic of love. And, when people are young, they're competing with their friends. Oh, my friends are getting married. I have to. So, but there is something magical about love. It's a drug. It does not last in its same form forever. It continually changes. It goes into cherishing and comfort and so on and so forth. So for those of you who think that the passionate love part remains forever, the only way that does is if you continually reinvent the marriage, which is a good idea to do.
And I think also if the person is really a friend, like a best friend, and I think that was something that I've read recently. Historian Stephanie Kuntz talks about the fact that there are now more friendship marriages and that these tend to be more stable, longer-lasting marriages because it's not about – oh, you're the provider, I keep the home. It's about we're a partnership and we're in this together. And I feel just really lucky that my husband is also my best friend because we have so many, now we have a history and then just such a similar outlook on life and take on things that it's kind of like a long conversation that keeps going.
I mean, you are so lucky, and I'm not going to say luck because you decided to choose and not be chosen. For all our listeners out there who are going to buy your book, one of my suggestions is always be the person who chooses. Never be the person that's chosen. Because very often, the person who chooses you, when you're lonely, it's like, I like him because he loves me so much or loves her so much. And what happens is one turns a blind eye to whether or not it's a fit. And they say, oh, this is great because I'm sloppy, he's neat, he loves, rock and roll, I love classical. It's such a balance. Well, opposites attract and then they kill each other. People who have more things in common and have a strong friendship, strong communication, but a strong identity outside the marriage, I find that they actually make the most stable couples.
Yeah, that makes sense. But it's also, yes, I chose my husband, but he also chose me.
Yes.
That's always the challenge, right?
Right.
There have been many men that I've chosen, but unfortunately they didn't choose me back.
Okay.
So it's
But you at least chose them.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? As opposed to just someone chose you and you say, I'm lonely and I'm getting older. And, you at least chose them, And that's the other thing that, we should tell every single person out there is that this, you have to kiss a lot of frogs, to get a prince or a princess. It could happen quickly. Lots of people marry their childhood sweethearts. Most of those marriages end in divorce or cheating. Because you don't really know what you want until you know who you are. And that sometimes takes a little bit of a longer time.
It takes a long time to figure out who you are. And I also think that, and part of what the book was about really honoring who you are and realizing that, yes, there are a lot of things that singles are told about why they're alone. You're too picky, you're too independent, you're too needy, you're too desperate, you're too intimidating. You have issues, you have low self-esteem. And the thing is that none of us has to be this perfect person in order to find love. You really just need to find the right fit. That was something that Dr. John Gottman talks about, the marriage researcher, that finding love is not a matter of having a normal personality or getting rid of all your quirks and your neuroses. It's just finding that person that you mesh with. And that can be a long, tedious process sometimes. Sometimes, I mean, I know a couple that they you know, she did marry her childhood sweetheart. They continue to be married and have three kids. So I think some people kind of hit it. They get lucky.
I got married at a very early age. Yeah. Met my wife at 17, and we were together 30 years before she died of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. But we had 30 great years. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of people could say that. And I'm happily remarried.
Yeah.
The idea of men and women, the way in which they're raised by their parents, why the double standard in your mind? And is there a difference in the way you have seen the messages that girls have gotten from their family versus guys?
I don't know so much about family as much as just the culture at large. I mean, that's not something that the message that women get in general is, hey, honey, you don't have much time. You need to please him. And there's also a general idea that if the relationship doesn't work out, or if you're not, if you decide, say, to end a relationship, then you're too picky, or you have kind of high standards. Where if the guy decides it's just like, well, you were probably on his case too much, or you were probably too needy. There's some way that women always get the message that they're the one who's wrong. And I think a lot of it is because, you know, someone asked me at my reading here in Brooklyn, right after the book came out, said, why are these books always written for women? And I said, because women buy the book, buy the books. And my editor and my publicist were in the front row, and they said, yeah, like, women are the ones who buy these books. It's probably for a lot of the reasons that you said earlier, but the problem is that women are great in that we really do try really hard to make relationships work, to work on ourselves, to make sure we're doing everything to kind of keep our own stuff together so that we're not expecting too much of the other person. But that can also lead to a lot of self-blame, too, where if things have not worked out exactly as you like, well, then the problem must be me. I must be the problem. And I feel like that, and I, as I say this as someone who's written a lot of women's magazine articles, you know, there's always a way in which the woman is treated like, you know, well, here's your problem to be solved. And certainly we all do have problems, and it's good to seek solutions. But there's a way in which I think in our culture there's just a sense that anytime you experience disappointment, it's your fault. There's nothing else that could be leading to it. It's always your fault. And honey, here's the 10 steps that you can do to make it better. And it just doesn't allow. There's not a lot of room in our culture for just saying, you know, sometimes it's just unfair.
See, it's interesting because one of the things which I do with the clients in my office, mm-hmm, is, I have a filing cabinet, or it's part of a desk with a locked drawer. And I ask them, do they have keys on them? I say, okay, take out your keys and try to open my drawer. And they look at me funny, and they take out the keys, and of course it doesn't open. I said, so okay, so who's rejecting who? Is the key rejecting the lock, or is the lock rejecting the key? And what's the answer? Neither. They just don't fit.
Right.
Okay, some people just don't fit. It's nobody's fault. It doesn't fit. Now, on the other hand, one has to be introspective and take a look and see, are there traits that are within me that is driving everyone away? Mm-hmm. Healthy men and women don't want overly needy people. Okay, they want a partner. They don't want a patient. Okay, they want someone who could share their life together, as opposed to you are now. A man or a woman saying, I'm not successful because my husband or wife brings me down. Well, you know what? That's not an excuse. Okay. You're responsible for your own success. So very often, people would get into the self-blame game, and I think guilt is a waste of everyone's time. Mm-hmm. But I think everyone needs to take an honest look of what they're doing to be healthy and to be in a healthy relationship. Are they being the best that they could be?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that approaching things from the point of view of what am I doing to sort of make sure that I am leading the happiest and healthiest and most whole life for myself. To me, that was the answer that I came to in my 20 years of trying unsuccessfully to find a relationship. I wrote a lot of these women's magazine articles, and I kind of used myself as a test case. That was I had.
You were advertising.
Well, I was also I had access to a lot of great therapists and experts, so I would kind of get my own stuff in there, you know, as I'm doing.
Exactly.
As I'm just because you know it was
free
I would be writing.
Therapy.
Yeah,
good Sarah.
I was writing the article for you know all of the readership, but you know, really, it was kind of through the prism of my own life, and. So there was this like, oh, maybe I'm too needy. Maybe I'm too independent. You know, I kind of went through all the reasons. And I saw that when I would see my friends, we would also be kind of trying to, you know, psychoanalyze ourselves and figure it out. And that's all really good. And it's good to try and find a way to have the most whole and well-rounded and happy life you can. But where I got tripped up, I think, was I kept, you know, I doing yoga, I was meditating, I was reading a lot of self-help books, taking acting classes to develop my confidence, all kinds of stuff that I did. And at a certain point, I thought, why isn't this working? Like, I'm so good. I'm trying so hard. I'm doing all the stuff. And here are these people I know who are very happily married, have been happily married for a long time. She's never taken a single yoga class. Like, she's got a lot of stuff. And that was kind of where it occurred to me that, that was where it occurred to me that this standard that I was putting on myself, that I had to be this perfectly self-actualized person in order to find a relationship, was unrealistic because none of the married people I knew measured up to
Sarah,
that.
Sarah, in one way, when we say unrealistic, it I would say that it was more than you probably had to do. Having said that, I think everything you did made you a better person and also created a confidence in the long-term aspect of your relationship because I'm looking at you and you look confident, mm-hmm. you know, and very confident within your marriage. So I don't think you really wasted any time. I think that you may have, in fact, came to the wrong conclusion that, you know, one doesn't have to do all these things in order to find love. But by doing all these things, you did really create some self-actualization. And I think it's added to your marriage. And I think it's one of the strengths of your marriage.
I absolutely agree. What I always say is that all of the work I did, it had nothing to do with meeting my husband. I just met him because actually, I had to go back to work for a little while. I'm a full-time freelancer, but I took a job for a little while, and he was there. So that was kind of an arbitrary set of circumstances that led to the meeting. And I feel also very confident that he would have liked me, even my more neurotic, less self-actualized self. However, I will say that all of that work that I did, I mean, it's definitely made me a happier and more confident person, and it has made me actually quite better at navigating marriage than I would have been had I not done that work. I can see the way that has made me able to deal with conflicts. And if my husband is annoyed with me, that is not a disaster. Like, he's just annoyed with me right now. He'll they'll get over it, or, you know, I'll figure out.
He'll find out that he's wrong and apologize.
Whatever. I mean, or if I did something that was not cool, well, let's find out what the issue is, and if it's something that I need to make up for, apologize for, I will. If it's just, you know, it doesn't catastrophize. So
you know what most women get most frustrated in marriages is men tend to lie a lot more than women, and they lie about the stupidest things. I mean, like things that aren't even that important, but the reason they lie is to avoid conflict because what happens with men in marriage is they don't like the fight.
Mm.
Okay, you know, they're in the world and they're, you know, trying to every day climb that ladder, and there's all the fighting, and they want, for the most part, to go home to quiet stimulation and fun and happiness. So they will lie, and women go insane with the lie because they jump to the conclusion, well, if he's lying about where those shoes came from, maybe he's lying about that he really loves me. Mm. Maybe he's cheating on me. And they'll take it to and so the one thing I want to add to anyone out there who is looking to actually be in a long-term relationship, lose the jealousy.
Mm.
Okay. Lose making a mountain out of a molehill. Realize that sometimes a fight is nothing more than we see things differently, so agree to disagree.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, can people have different political views and stay married? Yes, but don't make that the center of your marriage.
Mm.
Okay, because at the end of the day, you know, politics is normally just a reflection of opportunity and not necessarily a personal belief. You know. Some have personal beliefs, but those are the ones who, with the real integrity, they're the ones who never get voted for in office.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I comment on the political system. Tell me what women, if you were, a woman came to you in her late 20s, early 30s, and says, where can I find a man in New York City, and how do I go about doing that?
Oh, boy. That's a really hard one. See, that is not a question that my book really that has an answer for.
I'm
or
not
that
asking
I
the
really
book.
Have
I'm asking Sarah.
I don't have a lot of insight that isn't – I mean, I could say, have you tried online dating, which has now become this – awful cliche that married people say to single people that has become. But I think my philosophy on all this is that one doesn't have 100% control in one's life. There's just no way. I could walk out of here and get hit by a bus when we get off. You know, all that. So nobody really has complete control. And so all you can really do is work on what you can control, which is two things, sort of, you know, making your life as good and rich and interesting as possible, just for the sake of that. I mean, not necessarily for the sake of, you know, and I'm going to be this wonderful person, and then that'll make me so attractive, and some, you know, just for its own sake. And then do everything you can to leave the house and meet people, whether it's online dating, whether it's pursuing a hobby, friends of friends. I think I got a really good piece of advice once from Kate White, who was then the editor-in-chief of Cosmo. She wrote a book, and she said that she had met a woman who was always meeting people and had a great social life, and she said that she entertained. And at the time, I was living in a very small studio, not much bigger than this room that we're in now. And so it was not a place where I could throw any kind of great parties, but I took it to heart and I started being the person who organized the drinks night. Like, hey, everybody, we're going to go, get a beer after work. We're going to this bar, or things like that. And then I did actually move into an apartment that was larger and I could throw parties. And what that did was, it wasn't that I necessarily met anybody at my own birthday party or drinks meet, but it meant that I started getting more invitations, that when I entertained, people would reciprocate, and I saw that my social life opened up. So that was a really great piece of advice from Kate White that I got.
And actually, it's a great piece of advice, period. Meaning you want more action, get out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a small apartment, you know, have a party for claustrophobics. Or don't have a party for claustrophobics.
Yeah.
But the idea of actually pursuing what you want and being proactive is very, very important. I predict that the age of the internet dating is about to end because of all the horrific experiences out there. And there's going to be more of a personalized dating where somehow where you are matched up by not just you should go, I got a single friend that'll be great for you, but by someone who really knows you and knows the other person and is able to make adjustments. Online dating works. I met my second wife on Match.com. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I worked so many hours, you know, but I knew how to profile the person, and I knew that I was going to go out, and I went out on, you know, probably the 80 dates. Everyone was a good date, but if I didn't know that it was going to go further, I would not have a second. And but if you don't know, I find that Match.com in New York is used very often for struggling actors, actresses, and actors to get free meals.
Oh.
You know, you can't pay, and this is actually
right.
True. You know, one of my clients says, you know, I go out, you know, 6-7 times a week. I said, when do you get these guys at Match.com? Well, what are you looking for? A good meal.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
You know, so
that's
it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But I love the idea of being proactive. Give me some more words of wisdom that you would suggest and that come from the book.
Okay, give me a minute. I think that the entertaining thing, just to kind of elaborate on that idea, there's two things, which is, you know, I think especially in New York, we're really so conditioned to think about our lives in terms of, like, how do I get what I want? How do I succeed? How do I make these things work out for me? And so one thing, and this is comes from some of my training in Buddhism and meditation that I found really helpful, is to maybe put aside that project of me getting what I want and just saying, you know, how can I be helpful in this world? And it doesn't necessarily mean working at a soup kitchen or doing that, but just how can I move through the world with a focus on others? And that could just mean throwing a party so that other people can meet other people, and maybe just taking the emphasis off of yourself, and so that also when you meet someone at a party, you can just be interested in them. I was talking to a woman who said to me recently, well, how do I send that signal to let someone know that I like them? And how do you finesse that whole thing?
You grab them by the hand and kiss them passionately, okay? You know, that'll give a good signal.
Okay, that's one way. That was...
Now, Sarah, we have to say that Sarah is starting a Buddhist dating service where... she's not.
I'm not. But I said, what about putting aside this idea that, okay, I like this guy, I want to make sure he likes me or figure out whether this is the right person to me. What if you just went into it and you were just curious about this person? Just like, who is this guy? And not even necessarily from a, do I want, you know, to date him? Who is he going to be to me 5 years down the road? But just like, who is this guy? And just to kind of take a softer approach to your life, and also take an approach that, you know, so you go to the party and you think, I really want to meet someone. But that doesn't happen. But maybe you find out about a great apartment at that party, and that is the apartment where you end up meeting your future spouse. There's also the, you know, going after something with a single focus, I think, can be limiting. If you can just walk in the room, be curious about the people who were there, and just be curious about the opportunities that are there. So maybe you go to the party and you you don't find a spouse, but you find out a lead on a job. So it's just that idea.
I mean, you're so right, Sarah, but this is really coming from an evolved person, meaning you, okay? You
know, it's not that complicated,
Well, you know what? But it's not that complicated, but it's not done that often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens is people are needy and they look for their needs, and that's why what turns off men and women on the first date is when the first date becomes an interview.
Yeah.
And they talk about, you know, tell me about your past relationships, you know,
yeah.
What went wrong. Never talk about your past on the first date. Your first date should be about who you are now and where do you want to go and what you're all about.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be catch and not tennis, which means hear what the person says, digest it, and then say something.
Yeah.
You know, don't compete with them. Well, I went on this great trip. Well, I went on a better trip.
Mm-hmm.
Don't compete with them and don't interrogate them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because that becomes one of the worst dates possible.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, on what date do you think that a person should have sex?
Oh, I have no idea. I would never attempt to tell anyone what, because
I asked our engineer John about that, and he said before the first date.
Just get it out of the way.
Just let's figure it out and say, listen, we'll have a date afterwards.
You know, I think everybody has such a different comfort level with that. I am not, you know, I know people who were married who had sex on the first date, so it's not like I'm someone who say never, never, never. I really just think it's about using your own good judgment. And I think that's really what my book is about. And what I'm really trying to emphasize is the fact that we are all wise. We have this wisdom, but it gets sometimes clouded over with all of this advice that's out there and all of this information that's out there that kind of tells us that we don't really know what we're doing. And I think that most people deep down really do know what they're doing, but there's so much self-doubt about it. So
I love your optimism. Obviously, most people don't know what they're doing, okay, and are inherently ignorant, not stupid, okay, which stupid is the inability to learn. Ignorant means they don't have the facts and they don't really, because they're not taught it, just the way they're not taught how to be parents, just the way they're not taught how to be in a relationship, not to just get one. What do you do when you're there? So the lack of knowledge does not come, you know, it doesn't just appear to you. You really have to, you know, do some work to get these questions answered and to make sure that you don't just enter into a relationship, but how do you keep one? And unfortunately, I find people are dreadfully undereducated and unprepared. And that is why in a city like New York, where it is hugely single and there are many more women than men, even the birth rate in this country, there are more women being born than men. Those who are good listeners, those who take a real interest, those who could add value to the person's life, and also they accept the love in return. Some women want to be so nurturing they won't take anything for themselves. Big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
A balance is required, and a balance with spice. You know, something always has to be spicy about a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not, people will look for spice somewhere else.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that doesn't mean you have to open the door with, you know, a different negligee every day. But it does mean, you know, you don't get dressed in 14 pairs of flannels as the way you normally go to bed, because, you know, some of the biggest complaints was intimacy was amazing during dating and died after marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there has to be a real consistency, and sexual compatibility is absolutely an important issue. Having said that, sexual intimacy freezes emotional intimacy. So my suggestion, I have two girls who I raised, was get to know these people and get, you know, to build a solid friendship. And then, then the sexual intimacy will tell you whether or not this is going to be someone we could go forward with or a great friend. Mm-hmm. And I'm, and one of the reasons I'm so proud about my kids and Leanne and Melissa, and they're 38 and 32, is that they have remained friends with probably every guy they ever went out with because they built the friendship first, you know? And they have never abandoned their friends, girlfriends or boyfriends, for a new relationship, you know, which is the biggest mistake people make. They get into a relationship, they let all their friends go. Big mistake.
Yeah.
So, Sarah, tell me three of the best reasons that someone has to buy your book.
Three of the best reasons. Okay, let me think about this. Number one, well, I guess if this idea resonates with you that you are not a perfect person, but someone who is willing and able and ready to love, and you feel like you have realistic standards about what you're looking for, and it just hasn't happened, and you've just been beating yourself up a lot about why it is that you haven't been able to find this. I would say that when people write to me, and mostly women, as I said, but they say, I hear a lot of, yours was really the only book that helped, or, you know, I've read your book many times, it always provides me with a kind of comfort, because it's not just, I think a lot of people think about my book is quite fatalist, that there's really nothing you can do. And what I'm really suggesting is that people take a little bit more of a balanced approach to this. There's a Buddhist expression that I find really useful called not too tight, not too loose. So the too tight approach is just like, I've got to, you know, 30 dates in 30 days, and I've got to do every online site and do all this stuff and run around and try and, like, fix myself because obviously there's something wrong with me. So that's the too tight approach. And the too loose approach is just like, well, there's nothing I can do, so I'm just going to stay at home and watch Netflix. So both of those approaches are a problem. And my book is kind of a way of suggesting a way to balance all of the different sides of yourself so that you can learn to work with the fact that we don't always get what we want all the time, and to kind of ride that out without making a lot of judgment on yourself about, oh, I just on the subway going home from yet another mediocre date and I'm 34 and what the hell. So it's kind of about how to just deal with that evening when you get home, and sort of how to take it from there so that you're not so just subject to the whims of life, that you have this sort of solid foundation in yourself that you can kind of approach whatever happens in your life and just kind of make better judgments and get to that sort of core of wisdom. If you think that you do have this kind of wisdom inside of yourself, that you actually do know what's best for you.
Right.
My book is a guide.
And that is going to take some self-discovery, and probably there's a verse in scripture that says, everyone is right in their own eyes until the neighbor comes and sees things as they are. So it's always good if you don't feel connected with your own truths to try to get someone to help you to do that. I think that's always a great idea. The reason why I think people see some fatalism in your book is because you're honest, and it's not the traditional American go-go, do these 10 things and you will definitely get married. And that's what I liked about your book the most. What I liked about it is that it was real, it had substance and common sense, and it had some uncommon sense, which I thought was really good.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. We could probably go on, forever, but I do want people out there to realize that the sun is a little bit brighter when you're watching it with someone else, and life is absolutely more enjoyable with a partner. But if you think that dating is work, then if you really want to be successful in a relationship, then you need to realize that being in a relationship requires effort, not work, effort. I love what I do for a living. I work ridiculous hours, and I've been doing it for 39 years. But it's not work to me. I have to make an effort because of energy and remembering so much information. But with the person, make sure you like them.
Yeah.
Too often you hear, you know, I really love her, but I don't like her.
Mm.
You know, if you don't like the person, don't go on in the relationship. And know when to say, you know what, this is not working.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because there is someone out there for you. Know what you need to change and know what you really want to keep. You have to know yourself. Yeah. Now, that wasn't a Buddhist saying. The only Buddhist saying I remember from when a childhood is don't eat yellow snow. And it was a good suggestion when I was small.
That is a good one.
But anyway, a total pleasure having you. I know why you write for so many people, because you you bring a lot of substance to everything that you do.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Everyone, pick up a copy of her book, It's Not You, 27 Wrong Reasons You're Single, on Amazon.com or at your local Barnes & Noble's bookstore. If you want to know more, you need to read more. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. I want you to remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Check out our other episodes on GluckRadio.com and on YouTube by searching for Errol Gluck. Visit my website, www.glucksolutions.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/GluckSolutions, to learn more about how clinical hypnosis and executive life coaching could change your life in hours, not years. Thanks for listening. Till next time.